Good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Wally Derleth and Sheila Lawrence are at the phones tonight, but we do ask that when you call in tonight to be a little patient, as we only have two phone volunteers, which is better than one, which we've had for the past year, but they may have their hands full from time to time. We invite you to call in with your questions about our feathered friends tonight and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997. And he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, welcome back once again.
Hey, good evening, Bill.
It's certainly a scorcher out there. Hopefully you got some good AC in your truck out there.
I did, and I got hit by a couple of pop-up or popcorn showers on the way here. Some that you had to slow down to 20, 30 miles an hour on the highway because of visibility, and all of a sudden there's a couple inches of water on the road, and I wasn't the only one. I mean, people were pulling over. It was that bad. That was 3:30-ish. So, yeah, between Carthage and Shreveport, there's some good rains. I wish one of those would pop up over my yard.
Yeah, we're supposed to have some scattered showers and thunderstorms tonight. And so, you know, keep on the lookout, folks, out there. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any photos or audio that you would like to send in, you can send them to my attention at W Beckett, that's WBECKETT, at LSUS.edu. Once again, W Beckett at LSUS.edu. We won't get to those tonight, but we will save those for the next program of Bird Calls. Well, Cliff, as always, at the end of last month, you gave us a conservation tip, and would you like to recap that for us?
Sure. We talked about allowing flocks of beach birds to rest. You know, we've all taken those vacations down to the coast, and we see those flocks of birds that are sitting on the beach, and we think it's fun to run through them or send the unleashed dog through them. Well, a lot of those birds could be migrants that are in desperate need to rest and refuel, and it's not a good idea to do that. So just like with humans needing personal space, let's give wildlife some personal space, including on our beaches. You might think, well, the beach is vast. Well, good. That means you can skirt around that flock and don't need to go right through them. And I'm not talking about, you know, these groups of feeding gulls where people throw bread. That's another issue. I mean, try eating bread your whole life and see how that turns out for you. But just keep your distance. Respect birds and their need for space, just like anyone around you needs space. And actually, we've really come to know about personal space in the last 18 months or so with the coronavirus 6 feet away. So give more than that to these flocks of birds on the beach. Let them rest. Let them refuel. Some of those in the spring could have just flown over the entire Gulf of Mexico, which is a 500 to 550 mile distance, depending on where they took off and where they landed. So their gas tank is empty. They're very tired. So let them rest and refuel. Don't spook birds on the beach. And also when you're on the beach and you get dive bombed by birds, it's usually because you're stepping on their eggs. A lot of birds nest on the sand, like least terns. They'll build what's called a scrape. They just scrape away the sand, lay the eggs that actually look like sand and blend in really well. And so you don't know you're stepping on eggs. And I think 99.9% of us would never want to do that. and we're wondering why these birds are dive bombing us. Well, you need to step back, get out of there, skirt around, and move on. So give birds some distance when they're resting, refueling, or nesting.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question about our feathered friends in the avian world are welcome. And I saw this on my Facebook feed, and it was an interesting meme that somebody had put out, but I wanted to just run this by you and see if this is correct.
Okay.
They said that one of their mourning doves is showing signs of a swollen, infected beak, eyes, and are diseased as well. So they say you have to remind all bird lovers to take down your feeders for 2 weeks if a bird looks sick. Now, I don't know whether that's correct or not, but yeah, we're going to throw that out to our experts.
Yeah, we've really gotten there's been a lot of examples of sick and dying and dead birds at and around feeders in the last, in Texas, starting about January, February of this year, before the winter storm, and happening ever since. And actually, it's gone pretty viral across many states in the country about increase in sickly looking birds at feeders. And we have to remember that our feeders are an unnatural gathering of birds, and not just feeders, bird baths. So if you have a bird feeder, and I'm talking about a seed feeder, not a hummingbird feeder, a seed feeder or a bird bath, that's an unnatural gathering of birds. You're making birds, encouraging birds to get in close proximity, in close association with each other. And sickly birds are desperate for food and water. And, of course, they're discharging saliva and poop that could spread whatever disease to other birds. But this mourning dove is a classic description of avian pox, POX, and it's bad stuff. And it's natural. It happens. Just like diseases run through our species, birds have quite a few. And so take away that unnatural gathering, i.e. your bird bath, your seed feeder, and you'll be doing the birds some good. So that was a really good meme that you read, because it goes to the point. The point isn't what is it. If you're curious about what it is, you're not going to get a vet or a wildlife disease expert to tell you on the phone or email. Don't worry about what the heck it is. Worry about that there is something going on. Let's not continue it and contribute to it. So like that thing you read, is shut down the feeder or bird bath for a couple weeks, and don't be contributing to the problem. And so that's something to remember, and because otherwise there's no medicine. If someone said, oh, I'm going to go get that dove and put some ointment on it, first of all, you're not going to catch it. If you can, it's probably too late. A wild bird is not going to let you catch it. And if you do, actually, we're going to talk about that in the profile species. There are some diseases that can transfer from birds to humans when we do our profile species. We're going to talk about that. So we don't recommend you pick up sickly or dying or dead birds, because some of these things can transfer. Now, avian pox cannot, but several others that you'll hear about here in a few minutes will.
It almost seems as if sometimes our humanitarian instincts get in the way of being actual friends to the birds.
It is, and we feel like we're helping birds by feeding them and providing them with food and water, and we are, but we have to remember it's very unnatural. Birds did just fine for millennia before it came along. If you think about it, you know, people weren't doing this 100 years ago, and they certainly weren't doing it 200 years ago. So, and birds have been around for tens of thousands of years, so they are going to do fine without our food and our water. But what they're not going to do well with is if sick birds are finding these feeders, and here comes 15 of its healthy friends, and all of a sudden it spreads like wildfire. So don't contribute to that. If you see a sick or dead bird at or near your feeder, shut it down for a couple weeks. And we recommend to always keep your feeders and bird baths clean. You can do this with a simple solution of water and bleach, only 10% of which is bleach. And with the bird bath, you can shut it down for a sunny, hot day and just put it in the sun and let the hot sun bake the bird feeder when it's bone dry, and that can help as well.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. John from Fishville, please stay on the line. We've got to get to our profile species first, and we're going to go to that next. So what do you have for us this month?
Tonight we're going to talk about the rock pigeon, a species most of us are already familiar with in cities around the world. It goes by several other names, including rock dove, feral pigeon, domestic pigeon, and common pigeon. Let's listen to their deep muffled coos and distinctive wing beats here.
Now, are these the kind of pigeons that roost under my church's steeple?
Absolutely, yep. And this bird was originally confined to Europe, Russia, North Africa, and parts of Asia, but was soon domesticated as pets or for food and other uses, including carrier pigeons sending battlefield messages during wartime. The species was reportedly first brought to the U.S. by early settlers in 1621, and since then have spread like wildfire across much of the hemisphere, mostly in close association with humans in cities and farms. This is the species flying fast in flocks over cities or often perching on building ledges, windowsills, rooftops, or underneath bridges. They eat a variety of seeds and grains, mostly found on the ground. Because the species has been domesticated, there are numerous breeds of fancy pigeons of many different colors and shapes, and one can see this in most downtown flocks where pigeons congregate when people feed them. The sport of homing or racing pigeons is popular around the world and can result in individual pigeons getting disoriented and lost on occasion. Since they're domesticated and fond of humans, such individuals might show up on your porch or your bird feeder displaying a brightly colored plastic leg band, which is somewhat equivalent to a dog collar. If you find such a bird, don't bother trying to find its owner, as most don't want a bird that cannot find its way home. They want better genetic stock that doesn't get lost. And don't call your state's wildlife agency thinking they can help you find the bird's owner, as this is a case of a lost pet, not a wild bird. Although this pigeon has brought pleasure to those who've bred them and kept them in captivity, they've also brought and spread many diseases, including psittacosis, cryptococcal meningitis, histoplasmosis, toxoplasmosis, and encephalitis, all of which can be passed to humans. Pigeons also damage buildings, reduce agricultural yield, and compete with other domestic fowl and native birds for food. This bird's presence isn't always warm and fuzzy. To see a photo of a rock pigeon snapped by James Childress, please visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. It's amazing over the centuries how many invasive species have become endemic to this part of the world that we're not. Hummingbees right. being one of those, and now pigeons. I didn't know they were not endemic to this area.
Yeah, and the word endemic is not correct.
Okay.
So they become established is the correct word. And endemic means you're naturally found in this certain area naturally. And so what you're talking about, what we just discussed, is man's intervention. So these things, like you said, they become naturalized or established, and it's not the greatest thing in the world in many cases.
We have a way of mixing up the world, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
All right, we're going to go to our first caller tonight, John from Fishville. You are online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
Okay, I'm going to continue on with the pigeon thing. Cliff, can you hear me okay? My phones are really goofy right now.
No, you sound good, John.
Okay. Last time you were on, I called a question about feeding my pigeons out in the yard, and you said, oops, that might be a mistake because of these wild birds from up the road here are going to get used to that feed, and then this winter they'll go hungry. And so I stopped feeding the pigeons, and I thought, no, wait a minute, I'll go ahead and feed the pigeons. Now, these are tumblers from up in Illinois we've had for about 5 or 7 years, and we've got up to about 30 birds now. But I enjoy watching them so much. I decided to go ahead and not take your advice, but I'll feed these wild birds all winter long. Is that going to be feasible for me to do that?
Now, I would have never said don't feed birds in the winter. I've always said avoid feeding birds in the hot summer.
Yeah.
And so what I've always recommended is the alternative, and that's what's called a wildscape, and that means landscaping for wildlife, planting certain species of plants that will give back to nature. They're not just green, they're not just colorful, they actually have a purpose. They're giving nectar, berries, nuts, etc. So what I recommend in the winter is when it gets super cold and there's ice on the ground and birds can't find food, that's a good time to supplement. But we have to remember that's the key word. You're only supplementing the birds. You're not sustaining the birds. So your pigeons, are you keeping those 30 tumblers in cages? Do they come back home and get in cages?
Oh, yeah. They got a big thing there. They got nests and everything. Yeah. We feed them some regular grain, regular crumbles. Excuse me. But what I throw out in the yard here, it's always on the one spot. It's a wild bird mix. And I feed them a couple times a day, and they come when I go out there. They recognize my hat and everything. They come, I can almost step on them.
Yeah, and that's because they're domesticated. They're mm-hmm. used to you feeding them just like the dog and the cat. So,
but then during the time they're not there, then the little red birds and bluebirds and doves, they come in and clean up the feed that they don't have.
Yeah, and there lies the problem. And so those diseases I mentioned that the rock dove can carry, they can spread that to our native birds. And so the worry is with mourning doves. There's continentally a 14% decline in mourning doves over the last 40, 45 years, and that's not good. And the idea is that they're competing with other doves that are exploding, like pigeons, like white-winged doves, like Eurasian collared doves, and those three aforementioned doves are also probably spreading some of these diseases and not showing the signs of it. They're carrying it, but the mourning dove is quite vulnerable, is the thought.
Is that dove very small?
The small little dove is the Inca dove. And he's got little scaling or barring on it, and when it flies, it has a little bit of rusty in the wings.
Yeah.
That's the Inca dove. But the mourning dove is pretty standard-sized. I think most people are familiar with the stocky chest, the little beady head, and the long, pointy tail of the mourning dove.
Yeah, I don't think that's the ones we have. Now, if I change the feeding position, my yard is about 3 or 4 acres. If I change it every week and go feed them in a different spot about 50 feet away each time, will that change this issue?
No. I think if you continue to feed your tumblers inside their cage where the wild birds can't get in and share the feed, that's the answer.
But I don't enjoy watching them when they're in their cage. Come on.
Yeah. you got to enjoy tumblers when they're flying. That's when they're coolest, when they're doing their tumbles.
You're right. Now, these are the ones that flip over backwards.
Yeah.
Is that the tumbler?
Yeah.
Okay, because there's rollers and tumblers. I got these up in Illinois about 5 or 7 years ago and only brought 3 down. Now we're over 30.
Cool. So. All right. Well, thanks for the call, John. Appreciate it.
Keep up the good work, Cliff.
Thank you, sir.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And just a little audio playback here for those who don't know the difference between a mourning dove call and an Inca dove call.
Yep, that's Inca. It sounds like you're saying no hope, no hope. It's a two-note call. Good. And that's the mourning dove. It's not a good mourning dove. It's a crying, mournful, sad dove. So M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. Yeah,
I remember the first time I heard that, I asked my brother-in-law, actually, up in Ohio, oh, what is this bird? And I mimicked it. Mm-hmm. He says, oh, that's a mourning dove.
Yeah.
Now, he's a fisherman, so he's out there in the early morning
right.
all the time,
right.
and he knows a lot of that wildlife. So you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and while we're waiting for the next call to come through, we have some photos that were sent in, including this very nice photo by Chuck Olmey, who has submitted quite a few images for us, of a burrowing owl that you can see on our Red River Radio website and the post for Bird Calls. This is a spectacular
photo.
It
is, and Chuck's got a great eye for owls. I think he has a good affinity for owls. He sent us several owls in the past and other species, but this is a cutie right here. This is the burrowing owl that it's not really – it's a super rarity in our region here in the Piney Woods. You need to go west – into more desert, sandy country to find them. There's also a resident few in peninsular Florida, but it's a bird that gets into burrows. It's the one that occurs with prairie dogs. So if you've ever gone to a prairie dog town, say near Lubbock, Texas, this is the owl that might be working communally and living in harmony with the prairie dog. He doesn't eat the prairie dog. He's almost the size of a prairie dog. He just borrows a burrow and kind of he's kind of a squatter. You know, we probably all have family members that that want to shack up with us and they never leave. Well, that's maybe the equivalent of the burrowing owl. But they're eating large insects and reptiles and small stuff. And so the prairie dog likes the burrowing owl because he's a good sentinel. He's watching like the prairie dog, always watching for predators, whether it's a coyote or a fox running along on the ground, or it's an aerial pursuit from a golden eagle or a ferocious hawk. There's so many things that want to eat a prairie dog or a burrowing owl that they have to really watch. And then they, of course, retreat down into the burrows underground until those things pass. You know, there used to be black-footed ferret, which would run right in the hole with these guys and be predator of owls and burrowing owls and prairie dogs. But they have been extirpated. There's a program to try to breed and release black-tailed prairie dogs, and that's ongoing out west. It's amazing. I guess when you taste good like a prairie dog, everybody wants to get a little piece of you. So
there you go.
They're always on the lookout.
So, and you just blew my retirement plan, you know, to move into somebody's house and just stay forever.
Well, just make it sound cool. Say, I'm just a burrowing owl.
Yeah,
everybody loves a burrowing owl.
I'm sure they'll buy that. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Give us a call now at 800-552-8502. We have lines open. That's 800-552-8502. And Mark Pizzolatta is on the line right now. Mark, what's your question for Cliff? Hello, Mark. Well, there's a theory that you're on the line right now, Mark.
Is it a different line, maybe?
I don't think so.
Or is this a different caller?
All right. Well, Mark P. Okay. Well, we're just going to go on, and I don't know what happened there, but we'll just close that out. We've got some more photos to go through, so we'll stick with those and ask Mr. Mark to please call back and stay on the line and listen to us. Now, our next photo was submitted by Carol Gilbert. And we tried to get to this last month, but just could not make it in. It's not the clearest photo in the world, but it is clearly a bird with very colorful patterns.
Yeah, it's not going to be on the cover of magazine, but you can clearly see what's going on. It's a male cardinal, and it's brilliant red body plumage. It's big, heavy red bill, but a gray featherless head, and you're looking at it going, what's going on? Is the sky falling? Is it disease? Oh my gosh, this is normal summertime molt. And birds, we've mentioned this, birds are not evenly feathered across their body. They have six or seven tracts, T-R-A-C-T-S, tracts of feathers, and this is called the capital tract, the head tract. And so this cardinal in the picture has lost all his head feathers, and he's going to grow new ones. Molt happens at least once a year in birds. Feathers, as everyone's picked up a feather and noticed, they're fragile, and they wear and tear. So they have to be replaced. And so we're constantly replacing our hair and our fingernails. They're growing to replace damage. Well, a feather falls out at least once a year. Some species, it's more than that. And in this case, the cardinal is in molt. So don't freak out when you see a headless cardinal. Just realize he's undergoing molt. He probably doesn't want to be stared at and laughed at. He looks a little funny. But in a couple weeks, he's going to be good as gold.
I wish my hair grew back like their feathers did. So
yeah, that would be nice.
My head's been molting for 40 years.
And if you could figure out how to do that, you'd be a rich man.
There you go. All right, we're going to go next to Mark again. He is back online. Mark, what's your question for Cliff?
Hey, Cliff, how are you?
Mark, did I hear that you're a birthday boy today?
I am. I turned 65. I can't believe it.
Yeah. So for listeners who don't know, you're one of the voices of the radio station. You do a lot of the great commercials, and I was listening to you on the drive up here, and I heard that you are 65, and you even said, "Can you believe it?" And so here I am saying, "No, I can't believe it that you're 65."
Well, I can't believe. I really can't believe it either. But I'm excited to be hanging around at 65. You know, I raise pigeons and parakeets. Mm-hmm. I've got over maybe 150 parakeets I raised this year.
Wow.
And I have a lot of, you know, homing pigeons.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why I was calling today was this past week, I swear I saw a golden eagle over off of Burt Coons. Is that possible?
Well, golden
eagle. I know it wasn't a red-tailed hawk, you know, because I'm not familiar with those, but he looked just like
There are some all-dark morphed red-tailed hawks that look like golden eagles as far as color.
Okay.
And so if you're just basing your sighting on color, it could be a dark morph red-tail. Now, if you saw a golden eagle, they can show up many months of the year in weird locations. It's not unheard of, but I'm betting the more likely candidate is a dark red-tailed hawk, a dark morph red-tail. So
I was kind of wondering about that, but I kept telling myself, man, could that be a golden eagle over here? I was just kind of shaking my head, you know.
Yeah, I mean it could be, but you know, if we're gonna do hypotheticals, let's go with something that has a greater probability, and that would be the red-tailed hawk and a dark morph.
I'm gonna tell you a quick story, and I'll let you go.
Okay.
I started raising homing pigeons when I was five. But I started raising homing pigeons when I was around 11 or 12. And my dentist, Dr. Mansour, he was a real homing pigeon enthusiast, and he would cross homing pigeons with ringneck doves, and it would create a hybrid, of course, and he would call them a dovegen. And I remember seeing these all my life as a kid.
Huh.
And what was so weird, the dovegen, when it would coo, when it got up to the age of maturity to where it would coo, it could never attract anything because I guess the pigeon or the dove wasn't familiar with the type of coo that he produced.
Yeah, the dance and the song have to be just right or the girlfriend won't like you.
Right, but I mean, he called it a dovegen. I mean, are you familiar with that at all?
No, because that's domestication and raising cage birds. Homie, don't do that. So I do wild birds. I don't do cage birds.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, in talking about the Inca doves earlier, when they fly off, you ever notice that sometimes it sounds like a rattle or a rattle?
Yeah, yeah, they do make a little rattle with their wings, uh-huh.
Yeah, and I always kind of call them a rattlesnake dove, you know, because they sound like a rattlesnake when they take off.
Right, 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 cool.
Well, anyway, I love your show, but it's the best. I love it. Every time you're on, I listen to you the whole hour.
Well, we're honored that you're calling us on your birthday. Did you blow your candles out and get any good wishes? Are you allowed to tell us what you wish for?
Well, at my age, you really don't wish for anything, really.
How about another 65 years?
Maybe another 20 years. Well, thanks for bringing up my birthday there. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. You know? Well, I thought it was cool that you mentioned that. And actually, I think I looked ahead, and I think the November show, that's my birthday.
Oh, okay.
I think our November show is on my birthday. Let me just look. Yes, indeed. Our show, if we don't get bumped for any reason, like weather, sickness, pledge drive, November 9th is my birthday, so call back and wish me happy birthday. How about that?
I will. Well, look, you have a great show.
Great.
I really enjoy listening to you and Bill. Okay.
Awesome. Thank you, Mark.
Have a good evening.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. You'll get right in. All lines are open. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding the avian world and birds are welcome. And if you have a photograph to send in or a sound that you would like Cliff to identify, you can send those files to W. Beckett, that's W-B-E-C-K-E-T-T, at lsus.edu, and we will get those turned over to Cliff so he can help you identify those. Again, 800-552-8502. We're going to go next to our next photo submitted, and this one was sent in by Allison Scott, who wrote in and, you know, like so many, thought that she had the ivory-billed woodpecker.
Yeah, and what's cool is we get these from all over the country. I recall the last one was from the Northeast, Delaware, Massachusetts area. And this one, I think, was Florida. Do you know?
Yes.
Do you remember? Well, and it's great that they Google around and find out that the radio show, we've done a lot of stuff with ivory bill versus pileated. And the picture's great because it shows the back of the bird, and it has a black backpack. That's the easiest way to remember it. Everybody knows what a backpack is. Put your kid to school, send them off with a backpack. Is it a black backpack or a white one? And this one is a black one, and that's the pileated. If it was a white backpack, and this bird would be crow and raven size, then you got an ivory bill, but no one's been able to come up with one for a long time.
And the pileated really is the woody woodpecker.
It is.
Woodpeckers, so to speak.
It is. It's the one that they derived the cartoon woody woodpecker after. It's the one that's expected across, I don't know, I've never counted, probably 35 states, 30 for sure in the U.S. and up through Canada, most provinces of Canada, the southern reaches of, where there's wood. So it's not in the Rocky Mountains. It's not in the desert. It's not in the Great Plains, but it's just about everywhere else in the U.S. So pileated woodpecker, you've got to make sure you see the white backpack. Now, remember, red-headed woodpecker has a white backpack, but he is not much bigger than a cardinal. He's kind of blue jay sized. He's little. So an ivory bill, again, would have been crow or even raven size. We're talking a monster of a woodpecker. So.
And also the call sound, vastly different.
Vastly different.
Here's the pileated.
Okay.
I swear that sounds like something out of a jungle, you know, movie. And then we go to the ivory bill as soon as I can get that up here. Where's my ivory bill? There we go. More like a goose sound almost.
A toy trumpet is how a lot of authors described it in the old days. Sound like a little boy's trumpet.
Yeah.
And that you can hear static on there because that was recorded in about 1935 here in the state of Louisiana, not far from Monroe, closer to a town of Tallulah in the Tensaw River area. And it's now the Tensaw National Wildlife Refuge. It used to be the Singer Tract, and that's where James Tanner and Arthur Allen and Paul Kellogg recorded that ivory bill in 1935. How about that?
There you go. Louisiana's famous for that.
Yes.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Ben. Ben, I'm not sure where you're from. Could you tell us where you're from, and then what's your question for Cliff? Hello, Ben?
If it's my turn, it's Bill.
Oh, Bill. Okay. Well, they wrote Ben, so I'm sorry.
Well, I'm not. We don't want to jump ahead. She said I was next caller.
Yep.
Where are you calling from, Bill?
East Texas, Centennial, Panola County. I'm just across the Louisiana line into Texas over here.
Okay.
I had a property over on 79 just east of the river, and I did see, we've been doing some work on a barn, and everybody left, all my friends left, and I sat there eating a can of Vienna sausages and crackers, and you can see it glowing in the sunlight with a 6 foot or better wingspan, golden eagle. It took me a minute to register what it was, and then it perched in a tree, and then it flew back across. There's a little valley there. It was looking for a rabbit or mice.
Right.
But it was just east of within a mile of Sabine River there off of 79.
Okay.
But what I called to ask you about, uh-huh. I didn't see, but I've seen its signs, and I lost two cats pretty close succession. And my housekeeper went out there to get a big broom or a shovel, and said she run it off its roost in the middle of the day. Said it was a barn owl.
Mm-hmm.
But now I don't see it out there. I see some signs on the steel beams and you know, stuff a little on the floor, the great red phosphorus signs. How long do they stay in one place, and do they nest and leave, or what?
Yeah, well, first of all, barn owl, B-A-R-N, is not a expected species in East Texas. That is a prairie bird, where you can see them in the coastal prairies or up in the blackland prairies. They're just not around here. There are barred owls, B-A-R-R-E-D. There are great horned owls. Those are two of our biggest owls. And don't, you know, this is a case of guilt by association. So just because you see an owl one day and you're missing cats another day, don't put two and two together, because there's plenty of other things out there that are after your cats. Other cats, neighbor dogs, bobcats, coyotes, foxes. There's so many things out there. The road is a big killer of cats. We've all seen that. So your Michelin tires are a problem. So I wouldn't blame it on the owl as the reason you lost your cats. And again, we don't have barn owls in Panola County.
Well, this was a big. I didn't see it. Now my housekeeper, she
sure
saw it.
Sure,
but called it that. But I don't know who taught her ornithology, so we won't go there.
No,
but
that's fine. And we need owls. They're eating pesky rodents. They're keeping those in check.
And she could have been saying barred owl, but just, you know, slurred the word barn.
Yeah,
barred.
If she knew what that was. I mean, we have several species of owls, and so people are most familiar with barn owl. They're almost snow white. The underneath, they're very white. When they fly over you, they're very snow white. And so you really got to go to prairie country to see that bird, and I would be very dubious of one in Panola County. Very dubious.
I didn't execute it. I just moved my John Deere antique tractor out.
Yeah. No, but I mean we need these predators, Bill. If you don't want to be overrun with rodents and snakes, you better praise the predator, like these owls and hawks and other things. Because they are keeping those things in check. That's what they're after. They're not after your cats.
Well, like I say, my information come from a lady.
Yeah, secondhand.
So yeah. We won't mention that. She don't listen to your show. So, but
all right. Well, we appreciate the call, Bill. Thanks so much.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call now. We do have lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Elizabeth from Jefferson, Texas, you are on with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, I was watching Texas Country Reporter a couple of weeks ago. Well, in fact, it was July 24th. And I believe his name was Chris Duchart. D-U-C-H-A-R-T, or it may have been Duchant, from Austin, Texas. And he was telling about a bird that lives in the tower, in the Texas tower down there, and they call her Tower Girl. And I can't remember what kind of bird it was, but it was something rare. I think it was some type of falcon.
Yeah, there was a peregrine falcon that was nesting up in the tower, and I don't think it was mated, and I think that the eggs were deemed infertile. So I think it was a peregrine falcon, and a couple years ago there was people that were going up there, they were putting up cameras and taking video of the bird. They put in a box for it and all that, which is really cool. But the bird you're thinking of is indeed the peregrine falcon.
I was sure you'd heard of it, but it was very interesting. It was a very interesting story.
And the cool thing is, you know, this is the same tower that has the unfortunate historical event in the 60s where the gentleman got up there and shot, I don't remember, 15 or 19 people.
I remember that. Yeah. I'm old enough to remember
sad. Yep, that's the UT Austin campus. Yeah. So that's the same tower. So let's be glad there's something happy and favorable that's going on with this peregrine, and no more of that the ghost that's over that tower from the 60s. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Elizabeth. Appreciate the call.
Okay. I love your show.
Oh, great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Now, are peregrine falcons native to this area as well? Because I know up north in Ohio, they're very prevalent.
Yeah, and they migrate through here. So we don't have them summering with us. We don't have them wintering with us. They're more of a migrant. You see them in spring and in fall. But fall for that bird can be July when, you know, it's hot and summery. July, August, September, that bird can be coming through. So, yeah, I was just thinking about the tower incident. I have a friend who we had a common interest with screech owls. His name was Bill Arhos. He's passed away, A-R-H-O-S. He was in the TV radio world in Austin. He was quite a lot older than me. But anyway, he experienced that. Mm. He told me about going to UT when the shots were ringing. He laid down. And, I mean, it was pretty intense to hear his firsthand account of that event in the 60s. So, but, yeah, Bill Arhos was a good guy, A-R-H-O-S. I don't know if anybody knows him, but... he had that account that he told me about.
I know the falcon is my alma mater's.
Is it?
Yeah, okay. The peregrine. We have Peregrine Lake on Bowling Green State University in Ohio. So.
Yeah.
Yep, the Falcons, they made the Nationals once, I think.
Right.
That was back when Urban Meyer was their coach, and then he left,
gosh.
Of course. So, yeah. All right, we're going to go next to Dave from South Shreveport. Dave, you are on with Cliff. What's your question?
Cliff, I'm only about 5 miles from the radio station, and I live in Ellerby Road Estates, which is just a heavily wooded suburb. I think I've got this species narrowed down to a Cooper's hawk.
Okay.
And for a long time, we had two of them, and all of a sudden, there were four of them in the backyard, so they've evidently nested and had a couple of kids. This is a behavior I'm curious about.
Okay.
One of the adults comes down. I have a pretty good, I got over half an acre, and part of it is in a natural area. This hawk will come down on the ground and spread out its wings, and it's looking around, very alert, mm-hmm. and it'll spend 3 or 4 minutes on the ground. I've got a pair of binoculars. It's not eating anything. I don't think it's hiding anything. I don't know what it's doing. It's not taking a dust bath.
Usually that's called mantling. And when raptors, especially Cooper's hawk, and I like your ID, Dave, I think you're spot on, because that's a bird that has been increasing in cities around the country. It's tapping on doves that are in the city, great-tailed grackles. There's lots of good food for a bird-eating bird like the Cooper's hawk. But the display or the behavior you're describing is called mantling. And if it's... It usually does that when it's captured and killing, hasn't quite killed something, or something, it's got prey and something is trying to steal it from him. Like you'll see, I've seen them do it when they've got something in their talons, but there's 3 or 4 crows harassing the hawk. They might be more interested in scaring the hawk off versus trying to take the steal klepto their food from them. But anyway, it could be a young one that's practicing. I don't know, but that doesn't sound like sunning, and like you said, doesn't sound like dust bath. It sounds like mantling. And so that's the behavior that you witness, which is cool. And hey, if you've got them nesting in your yard, I'm jealous. I'm envious. I would love to have a pair of Cooper's Hawk nesting in my yard, because I'd love to watch them, see what they're doing. They're fairly noisy. You know, the very loud. My parents had them nesting in their yard long after I moved away when I went to college. So this was years later coming home. I couldn't believe that Cooper's Hawks were nesting in urban center of Dallas, is where I grew up and where my parents live. So yeah, Cooper's Hawk are on the increase. That's one of the birds that's on the increase, and it's a neat one. And so yeah, you're a lucky guy, Dave.
Well, we feed the birds year-round, mostly black oil sunflower seeds. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the expensive blend that has peanuts and other stuff in it. But the only thing I've got left is a pair of cardinals. I can't even find a Carolina wren around here.
Yeah.
Did the Cooper's Hawk eat them all up?
No. A Cooper's Hawk would find a Carolina wren as a single Cheeto when it needs a bag of Cheetos. And so it's not going to waste
snack.
Its time. Yeah, not even a snack. And so... No, Cooper's Hawk. Now, the sizes are different in between the sexes, which is interesting. The female being larger than the male. And so with that, there can be a little non-overlap of segregation of the prey items. So the smaller Cooper's Hawk male can feed on smaller birds, but that's still going to be probably blue jay size, cardinal size, you know, nothing smaller than that. And then the female Cooper's that's larger, she's going to feed on even, you know, slightly larger birds than that. Maybe a pigeon that we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. That would be a favorite of a female Cooper's Hawk. So, no, I think this is the time of the year, Dave, where a lot of birds get quiet. They get skulking. If you're not out at 6:30 when the sun comes up, that's still the most active time of the year, of the day for birds. But it's just so hot and miserable, just like we are miserable in it, the birds are too. And I think they're out there, they're feeding, they're still alive. They're also not singing because they're at the end of the breeding season, which means they're done singing for territoriality or attracting a mate. And they're maybe at the downward end of focusing on feeding young. And that's another reason you don't hear a lot of birds. It's because they're busy tending to young. But I think we're at the end of all of that, and it's just in that typical time of the year where things get pretty quiet and the sky's not falling. It's just they're miserable. I don't want to sit out in the heat either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have one last question.
Sure.
Because I've got four of these and they seem to like my backyard, from time to time I run across a feather, and they're beautiful. And I just have a little spot in the garage I stick them in. One of my neighbors was by the other day and said, "Where'd you get the feathers?" And I explained where I got them, and he goes, "I think technically that's illegal." Hmm.
Yes, and the answer is correct. Your neighbor is correct, but I'll tell you this. Law enforcement doesn't go around looking in garages for people that have picked up feathers.
That's a relief.
Yes, but and I've mentioned this on the station before. I work for a state agency with game wardens, and they often pick up people that have feathers on them. And in this particular case, it was a big raptor feather dangling from the rearview mirror of a car. He pulled up to a stoplight, looked over, and there's a driver with a raptor feather hanging, and so he pulled him over, and it turned out to be a caracara. And so that you're not supposed to be in possession of native bird feathers like a caracara, or in your case a Cooper's Hawk. So it's you're not supposed to have it, and just be cool about it. The bigger problem is like at flea markets and craft sales, people that make bouquets, they sometimes will, like you, pick up feathers in the yard and add those to their bouquets. And then they sell it. You can't do that.
Usually I just give them to the neighborhood kids, and they seem thrilled. So.
Yeah, and I think if you take some pictures and videos of your nest and say, look, if somebody does come down on you, because we're tracing your call right now, Dave.
No, we are not.
I don't know if you knew that. But I'm on the call trying to stall you so you don't see that the law enforcement's pulling up. No, I'm totally kidding. So anyway,
world's paranoid enough. We don't need any
more. I'm kidding. But I do want to make a shout out for people not to use wild bird feathers in bouquets that they're selling at a flea market or a craft store or online. It's illegal.
Yeah.
And so just be cool about it.
Okay.
And so don't put it on Facebook. Hey, look at all these feathers I've collected. Because we have game wardens that patrol the internet. Because there's a lot of black market stuff and illegal trade and sale going on the internet.
Sure.
It's not going to be feathers that they're really looking at, but they're looking for other hot topics. The sale of protected species, the sale of species that we're not allowed to have, like coatis, coata mundi, if you want to look that up in Texas. So. I think you're cool, Dave. I would get some pictures and some video because that's super cool, again, that you've got Cooper's Hawk. So thanks for the call.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have other calls to get to right now. Jack, by the way, we lost you from Frankston, so please call back. Hopefully that's you on the line right now. But we're going to next to Russ from Princeton. Russ, what's your question for Cliff?
Good evening, guys. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Where's Princeton?
It's just outside of Halton, kind of between Bossier and Minden.
Okay. I thought this was the university.
Yeah, okay. Princeton, Louisiana.
Yeah.
Good.
I recently moved from Minden, where I had quite a few birds visiting my feeder, to more of a rural area. And it doesn't seem to, I can't seem to attract the birds to my feeder, even if I reposition them in various spots around the location. And I was curious if it had something to do with the abundance of food right now.
It does.
Which is keeping them from discovering the feeder itself.
Yeah, they don't need to resort to that. So they're... I put it this way. They would rather eat Mother Nature's home cooking than that stuff we got out of a fast food cellophane bag, which is
gotcha.
What you're feeding. So, yeah, I was listening to you thinking that this is a good thing. You probably got some good habitat with a lot of plants that are giving back to birds, and I wouldn't worry about it. I would think you've got a good thing going and maybe add a few more. If you don't have, for example, if you're not seeing butterflies and hummingbirds, put in some salvias or Turk's cap. Try to get some
gotcha.
Of these nectar-loving birds in there.
Well, the hummingbirds and the butterflies and especially dragonflies don't seem to have an issue. They're there in abundance.
Well,
I've even got some kites and some exotic birds that I didn't have when I was in town. But I've got nothing visiting the feeder, and I'm like, what am I missing here? But
well,
I thought maybe it might have to do with they're out eating protein right now.
Right.
Not on a seed diet.
Well, I'll tell you this, Russ, from what you've described, this is a good problem to have. And the move you made sounds like a good one because you're getting into a more harmonious setting out there in the wild. So good for you.
Well, I do appreciate you guys taking my call and, keep up the good work.
All right. Thanks, Russ.
Take care.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. We have one more caller on the line, John from Fishville, calling back. John, what's your question again?
I was just listening to the thing about the being against the law to have these feathers. What's the deal? Why is that against the law?
You can have your tumbling pigeon feathers.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's a domestic bird. So we're not talking about domestic birds. You can, if you're a hunter and you've got a license and you collected that turkey or that mallard, with a valid hunting license, you can have that. But everything else that's native, songbirds, for example, owls, for example, woodpeckers, for example, you cannot possess the feather of these birds. The reason being, you can't prove how you got it. So
I gotcha.
So the best thing to do is just not possess it. because you can't say, oh, I found it on the side of the road, or I found it in my yard. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, well, there, I find a few there in my backyard where I feed all these crazy critters. And I just, they're so beautiful.
Yep.
And I'll pick one up, and but I didn't realize I was breaking the law.
Yeah, and it's, and I don't even like to say that it's breaking the law. Again, it's if you're going to take those and start selling them.
Yeah.
Or putting them in your artwork and selling the artwork.
Yeah.
That's a bad thing. Don't do it.
Yeah.
It also discourages the hunting of those because a lot of people might want to shoot those to get the feathers to do that kind of, you know,
maybe
artwork,
so. And,
you know.
And if you do find a dead bird or it hits your window or you ran over it, someone else ran over it, you might think, well, I'm going to give it another life and keep the feathers. You need to think again. Give it a proper burial and be done with it.
Yeah.
Okay?
Well, okay, but I thought, whew, that's kind of crazy.
Yeah. All right.
Well, hang in there. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, John.
All right. We're going to see if they can get this call into us quick. If not, then we may not have time for it. In the meantime, I just wanted to show folks a photograph that I saw on Facebook, which is a Audubon a photographic award for an amateur photographer. A lady named Carolina Frazier captured this roadrunner taking a dust bath, and it is a spectacular.
Yeah, and she snapped that somewhere in South Texas.
Yeah.
Somewhere, I think, near Carrizo Springs or Catula. Yeah, Catula, I think. Somewhere on a private ranch, and boy, the stars aligned that day.
Right.
She just got the right angle with the sun and the bird and the dust bathing, and it's a pretty cool, jazzy picture.
Spectacular photo.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got one more caller. Lori, we've got to get your question in quick, or Louise, I'm sorry. Give us your question, and Cliff will answer that quick.
Hey, y'all, it's your old friend, Louise.
Bald Eagle Louise?
It's Bald Eagle Louise.
Hey, all right. I like your nickname.
I like it, too. I've never been called that, but I'm going to go with that from now on.
All right.
Hey, I've got a question more about the cardinals because I've got a bird feeder and I've been watching all these cardinals lately and I've been just thinking, oh, look at these, they must be juvenile.
We got to make this quick, Louise. We're running out of time.
But are they molting or are they juveniles, Cliff?
Well, the juveniles will have a dark bill. So the best way to do it is look at the color of the bill. The male cardinal, the adult, has a red bill. His girlfriend as an adult has an orange bill, brightly colored. The juvie of both has a dark, almost black, dark gray bill. So that's maybe the best way to do it real quick to tell you.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah.
I'll do that. Thank you.
Okay.
Right.
Well, thanks, Louise. Bald Eagle Louise.
I like that. Talk to you all later.
Thanks. All right. Bye-bye.
And let's get to our conservation tip for this month.
The title is Take a Kid to Your Local Landfill and or Sewage Treatment Facility. Yep, those sound like odd field trip choices, I know. But this is a classic case of out of sight, out of mind. Adults and kids alike need to know and appreciate where the water goes when they flush the toilet or what happens to the trash each week. When we know trash doesn't just magically disappear, perhaps we will work harder to generate less of it. The kids will be amazed to see the gigantic pits that are dug where trash is dumped and later covered up with dirt with the hope that it will decompose in the next century or two. And treating waste is a very resource and water-intensive process. Conserving water will lessen the amount of waste flowing through our pipes. Take your child, grandchild, or young friends to one or both of these sites nearest you. Believe it or not, some sewage treatment facilities with their settling wetland ponds can be great birdwatching spots for shorebirds, waterfowl, and more. Be sure to get permission from the facility before accessing and birding at those wetlands. Flushing our toilet and watching the garbage truck haul off our waste doesn't mean that because we no longer see that, it's magically disappeared from our planet. All of our actions have consequences. Do it for the birds.
All right. Cliff, I want to thank you once again for being our resident expert and ornithologist here on Bird Calls.
Great. Thank you, Bill.
You've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, and he is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio and the state ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everyone at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this program. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Bird Calls is produced by Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, and we had phone bank assistance tonight from Wally Derleth and Sheila Lawrence. The sound files for tonight's program can be found at zenocanto.org and were recorded by Stanislav Zwierza of Poland. And this month's bird photo was snapped by James Childress. The audio for tonight's program will be up on our website very soon at redriverradio.org. And please join us on Tuesday, September 14th, for our next program of bird calls. And next Tuesday will be What's Bugging You here on Red River Radio. This is Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public media service of LSUS and the voice of the community. This is KDAQ Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Camden Magnolia, KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches, and KTYK Overton Tyler Kilgore. We also broadcast on translator K214CE in Grambling. Stay tuned. Radio Lab is next here on Red River Radio, your voice of the community. And we are here to serve you. We are glad you are here for us.